Living beside and besides the academy, an ethical response. A few years ago, I was looking through some of my files in the basement when I found the final evaluation for my senior thesis in religion. I loved writing that thesis. It was my introduction to debates concerning definitions of woman and to the tensions between feminism and postmodernism. Since it was an honors thesis, I worked on it for the whole year. I remember carrying a big gray file box filled with my research around with me as I went to my senior sem in Old Main. What an academic nerd! I thrilled at being exposed to so many new ideas and exciting debates, and I deeply appreciated how much time I got to spend on researching, writing, and revising. Thinking back to those heady days of burgeoning academic nerdiness, I wonder, what happened? Why don't researching and writing academic essays thrill me anymore? I'm struck by the first line of the evaluation. This was, without a doubt, a very strong thesis. Indeed, we could not remember one in our experience that was stronger. Am I living up to the promise of that thesis? Sometimes this question haunts me, like when I look through my old academic papers or the three filing cabinets, jam-packed with hundreds of academic articles from 10 years of grad school and 6 years of college teaching that I've barely touched in over 2 years. So many years of dedicated research and thinking academically about religion, ethics, agency, subjectivity, feminist theory, resistance, subversion, queer theory, pedagogy, and more. What was it all for? Why did I stop? And what do I do now? These questions speak to a bigger crisis within higher education. As institutions struggle with rising costs and the increasing pressure to create programs and degrees that are profitable, some of higher education's toxic values have become even more unbearable for its most vulnerable workers, especially adjuncts and temporary visiting assistant professors like I was for 6 years. Stories like mine, of promising scholars getting burned and burned out in the academy, are popping up at academic conferences, on Twitter and Facebook feeds, and on blogs and online news sites, as workers share their stories and mobilize to make visible their unjust treatment by a system that seems, if not broken, in dire need of radical restructuring. But right now, I don't want to offer a big-picture analysis of the problems with the academy or a list of ways to restructure it. Instead, I want to discuss how I've been exploring, struggling with, ruminating on, and then responding to the haunting questions that higher education in its current state prompts for so many. The questions, what happened, and what do I do now, are necessarily historical, political, social, and economic questions, but they are also ethical ones. I'm interested in exploring their implications for the development of my moral selfhood. In 2013, my explorations became the basis for a book-length series of accounts documenting my intellectual history and my struggles to make sense of my relationship to the academy after I left it in 2012. Through the process of writing those accounts, I began to craft an alternative trajectory for my work and my critical, creative, scholarly self, one that led me to a space beside and besides the academy. So why did I lose my passion for academic research and writing? When I entered graduate school, I believed that the immersion in ideas and theories that it promised would provide me with the tools to make sense of my worlds and would enable me to have deeper, more meaningful conversations with a wide range of people. To a certain degree, this happened. But at some point, my training turned me into a particular sort of critical thinking academic self. A self who thought too much and too narrowly about my particular area of study. A self who was unable to speak with anyone, even non-academics, without citing all my sources, name-dropping at least two theorists, or classifying my ideas within a particular school of thought. A self who was trained to pick apart ideas and authors instead of engaging with them, and who felt increasingly distanced from the people, ideas, and sense of purpose that had motivated me to be a student scholar in the first place. This critical thinking academic self was largely crafted through my exposure to the following toxic academic values. Toxic academic value number one. The primary goal of an education is to know and acquire facts in order to master a discipline. Being exposed to thinking critically about and developing ways to summarize and assess foundational theories in a discipline is very valuable, But mastering a discipline often results in the belief that we should or can know everything about a certain area of study. Devoting all of our time to knowing an ever-increasing number of facts, theories, ideas, schools of thought, and specialized jargon in one specific discipline can prevent us from deeply engaging with those ideas, theories, or authors, or each other. It can prevent us from giving serious attention to how what we read moves or unsettles us. And it can prevent us from seeing how the theories in our discipline are connected to other methods and approaches across the disciplines and outside of the academy. Prioritizing mastery can also contribute to a loss of our own voices, as we spend all of our time acquiring concepts and mastering the ideas of others. Toxic value number two. Academic work must, at all times, maintain high standards and be rigorous. In addition to acquiring facts and theories in order to master a discipline, students are trained to be rigorous and to critically dismiss and often publicly reject work from other scholars that they deem to be unsophisticated, too subjective, or not rigorous enough. In this environment, critically assessing others' work frequently becomes less of a practice of serious engagement and more of an exercise in the trashing of ideas that don't fit the narrow focus of who and what counts as rigorous. This trashing enables academics to police the borders of good scholarship and to demonstrate their own worth and status as super smart experts. Standards and extensive training in the tools and concepts of an area of study are valuable and necessary, but academics need to spend less time policing the borders of who counts as a scholar and more time engaging in the difficult labor of exploring who benefits and at whose expense it is when standards and rigor are invoked. Toxic value number three. Academic speaking and writing should be objective, formal, rational, impersonal, highly complex, lengthy, and confident. In their academic writing, scholars should not make I statements or provide details or examples from their own lives. One should not insert oneself in the writing. It's too informal and subjective. Scholars should also make confident and persuasive truth claims. These claims should not demonstrate uncertainty or ambiguity for fear that they will undermine the expert scholar's authority and ability to be taken seriously. Moving outside of our limited perspectives and biases and aiming for some sort of objectivity is an important practice for serious and meaningful engagement with ideas and others. And being able to effectively communicate our work in ways that are compelling and that demonstrates insight is essential. But the academic demand to ignore the scholar as person in our writing perpetuates the myths that we can transcend our particular perspectives and political motivations in our scholarship, that they somehow don't influence how we pose questions and develop theories, and that our daily lived experiences don't matter and aren't important enough for scholarly inquiry. Additionally, the goal that we persuade others to believe in our ideas and our perspectives frequently shuts down critical and creative collaborations and conversations. Toxic value number four. Academic work must fit appropriate forms of scholarship and demonstrate your worth as a useful and productive scholar expert. Academic scholarship should be produced in the following forms. 1. An academic book, ideally published by a highly prestigious publisher, that will be read by a handful of people but never cited in their work. 2. A journal article, rigorously reviewed and published in a top-tier journal, that is kept behind a paywall and only accessible to those with university affiliations or expensive journal subscriptions. 3. A highly formalized lecture talk given at a conference where the only attendants are your fellow presenters and one or two others, and where the only questions asked aren't questions, but opportunities for the asker to devalue and dismiss your work or pontificate on their own brilliant research. The standard products of academic labor are valuable and enjoyable. I still thrill at painstakingly reading through journal articles, writing countless notes in the margins, and ruminating on the theories and the questions they prompt for me. And I love attending talks by smart intellectuals who present revolutionary ideas that transform my perspectives. But academic books, journal articles, or conference presentations are not the only forms that should count as scholarship. This narrow vision leaves a lot of very smart, serious, and important work out. Work that critically challenges dominant academic norms, that frequently bridges the gap between academic and non-academic communities, and that critically and creatively imagines new ways of engaging and being a thinking, writing, feeling, scholarly self. These academic values are shifting. Critical conversations about their limits are taking place between scholars in a number of interdisciplinary departments and inside and outside of the academy. But these critical conversations have been happening for decades, long before I started graduate school in 1996. How much has really changed? And how much can change, especially now that colleges and universities are experiencing extreme budget cuts and the pressure to justify their own existence? The academic spaces where challenges to harmful academic values have been taking place, gender, women, and sexuality studies and ethnic studies, are at greatest risk right now. They're being consolidated or eliminated, and even when they're not being cut, scholars working in them are being actively discouraged from discussing or practicing methods that don't fit with the larger unified vision of what higher education is for and what it does. In this current climate, how entrenched are harmful academic values, and how central to academic life are they? In many of my graduate classrooms as a student and a teacher, we read and discussed important critiques of these values. And as a scholar, I spent over a decade immersed in thinking, writing, and feeling the force of these critiques. These experiences gave me invaluable tools for troubling and resisting dominant academic norms. When I left the academy, I drew upon these tools to rewrite my narratives as a student. I focused on experiences of my student life that were often read as failures, distractions, or obstacles within the dominant academic narratives of success. Experiences that would be left off my official academic transcripts. While recounting my life as a scholar and closely and critically examining my own archive of academic documents, I crafted an unofficial student transcripts. Here's a little background on my project. During the fall of 2012, my first fall since I was five that I hadn't been in school as a student or teacher, I began work on my intellectual history. I decided to use my own archive as the source material for critical and creative reflections and interrogations of life as a student. As I began digging through my files in the basement, I found many key documents. The final evaluation for my senior thesis, a copy of my master's proposal, papers with my teacher's comments from my first year in college, name tags from conferences, and old student IDs. I also explored my digital files, searching through hidden folders dating back to college, and discovered past papers, presentations, my senior thesis, my master's thesis, and my dissertation. Looking back at these materials, both the physical and the virtual, conjured up a mix of emotions that made me feel joyful, sad, nostalgic, angry, and conflicted all at once. In order to spend time working through my conflicted feelings, not so much to resolve them, but to learn to live with the discomfort and uncertainty that they generated, I started writing. I began looking through past accounts I'd already created on my blog or in digital stories, and combining those with new reflections. I read through old papers and wrote about how my perspectives as an undergrad or early grad student had shifted, been complicated, challenged, or reinforced. I experimented with a number of different online tools for archiving and articulating my accounts. I posted initial drafts of the accounts and my thoughts about the process on my blog. I tweeted pithy reactions and reflections about the academy, frequently in the form of haikus, on Twitter. And I posted images of my artifacts with brief stories about them on Tumblr. Then, to bring my various accounts together, I created an interactive book using iBooks Author. I named my intellectual history project Unofficial Student Transcripts because, although it is a record of my student work within the academy, and while I've included many documents that might show up on an official transcript, the accounts that I give are unofficial. My perspectives and approaches to understanding the work that I did and the value of my education are not authorized by the academy or the institutions that I attended. In fact, my accounts frequently come into conflict with the official story about why and how one gets an education, earns a PhD, and trains to be an academic intellectual. Moreover, the work that I've chosen to value in these transcripts is not my grades or degrees or the products of scholarship, like my thesis or dissertation, that enabled me to earn those grades and degrees, but it's the often invisible thinking, feeling, engaging, and resisting work that occurred in the midst of my official academic labors. In a series of sections on my early years, college, master's, PhD, and post-PhD, I write about a lot of different work, including how I performed one of my first acts of resistance to my education in elementary school, how my failure to get into my dream graduate school might have helped me to be a better troublemaker, how I've spent over 15 years trying to make sense of a passage that I first encountered in a book by Judith Butler in 1997, how I felt intimidated and devalued by academic culture as it was practiced by some grad students in my philosophy classes, and how my dissertation, which was only read by a few people and was never published, gave me a plan for living beside and besides the academy. I'm very glad that I wrote this book. Not only was it joyful, especially when I created a series of quizzes playfully poking fun at academic values, but the process of working on it has enabled me to engage deeply with my student life. When I began writing unofficial student transcripts, my overall goal was to document and give serious attention to all of the work that I've done as an undergraduate, master's, PhD, and post-PhD student. I didn't just want to forget it. Leaving documents to languish in my basement or files to eventually be unreadable on an outdated computer, I wanted to remember it, to honor it, and to take it seriously. Taking my student life seriously has involved identifying, interrogating, and unlearning those academic values that were harmful to me, and creating and learning a new relation to those values that could make room for my own troublemaking and undisciplined approaches. So how am I reworking my relation to those academic values in unofficial student transcripts? First, to counter the narrow forms of scholarship that are privileged in the academy, I'm experimenting with new forms of critical and creative expression. I'm using new media and then bringing it all together in an interactive book that's available for free on my website and on iTunes. Second, to counter the rigid, jargon-filled, and impersonal writing style that is expected in serious academic work, I'm using informal language, lots of I statements, and including very few references to theorists or their theories. I'm not presenting my ideas as the answer, but including expressions of uncertainty and discomfort and acknowledging the limits of my own perspectives. And instead of focusing on the big thinkers in a discipline to prove my points and my status as a smart expert, I'm looking almost exclusively to my own experiences as the subject and object of my analysis. Third, to counter the use of rigorous as the standard for policing the borders of who and what counts as scholarly, I'm envisioning a new way to assess the value of scholarship by asking, does it make us curious? Does it keep our important conversations going? Does it move us to struggle? Does it encourage us to pay attention and take seriously the experiences and ideas of a wide range of folks? And fourth, to counter the expectation that the primary goal of an education is to master a discipline, in my project, I've shifted my attention away from documenting how, over the course of my time in school, I've acquired and know a lot of theories, to giving accounts of how I've engaged with ideas, conversations, experiences, and the values that I've encountered as a student. But what does it mean to engage? To engage is to participate and become involved with the ideas, authors, and perspectives that we encounter, and to establish meaningful connections with them in ways that require thinking about not only what they mean, but what they do, and what they do to us. To engage is to give attention to feeling and experiencing, not just knowing, and to unlearning, not just learning. To engage is to work on feeling the effects of ideas, experiencing the force of the questions posed by what we're encountering, and processing how we are implicated in a theory. This can help us bring more of ourself as persons, intellectual, spiritual beings, bodies, into our work. My practice of engagement in unofficial student transcripts involves asking a lot of questions about my student life and tracing both my perpetuation of and resistance to dominant academic values. Through the writing, thinking, feeling, resisting process of this project, I wanted to feel the force of my academic training, both the authorized through dominant academic norms and the unauthorized through critiques by academic, non-academic troublemakers. And I wanted to feel the force of my haunting question, why did I lose my passion for academic research and writing? But as I worked on this project, I realized that it wasn't just about taking my student life seriously or reflecting on and trying to answer my haunting question. It was also about carving out my own space where my vision for how to be a creative, critical thinking, and engaged self might be possible. I imagine the space as existing besides, as in addition to, and beside, as in next to, the academy. I love the concept of besides and beside. Understanding myself as living besides allows for an additional approach other than the academic way of being that I had been trained to believe was the only way to be an intellectual, the only way to do something valuable with my PhD and my promise as a scholar. Living besides opens up the possibility for other models, other approaches, other directions, other perspectives, and other ways to answer the haunting questions. What happened? And if not this, then what? Understanding myself as living beside the academy enables me to craft a relation to the academic norms that is neither for nor against them. I'm not interested in fully rejecting or endorsing the academic values that help shape who I am or how I engage with the world as a troublemaking, undisciplined scholar. Instead, I'm rethinking and reworking those values, creating possibilities that have been deemed impossible, and imagining worlds that have been unimaginable within the academic spaces that I've inhabited. For the most part, I envision beside and besides not as any one physical space, but as a new relation to the dominant academic values that have played such a central role in making me who I am, a new way of understanding and of using them that isn't about uncritically following or completely rejecting them. However, I do also understand besides to exist in actual space. But where? Right now, my besides space is online, on my trouble blog, my undisciplined website, and my new storytelling project, The Farm. Working in these spaces has enabled me to find a voice and to cultivate meaningful practices of thinking, feeling, resisting, and engaging. I wonder what other spaces exist for being besides and beside. Is it possible to create the space within the academy? Is there room to be a different sort of scholar, a different sort of intellectual self? As I worked on my intellectual history and now continue to wrestle with the questions of what happened and what do I do now, I've realized that there was always another question implied by my critical and creative explorations. What is an education for? I see the is in this question to be more about imagining possibilities. What can an education be for? Than dictating prescriptions, that is, what should an education be for? Here are some answers that I've come up with. I'd like to place them beside and besides the current should answers, which are learning marketable skills, earning a degree, and getting a job. Again, what is an education for? To develop new languages for understanding myself and the world. To connect with ideas, authors, other people. To cultivate and practice being curious and capacious. To be exposed to new ideas, new worlds, new ways of being. To harness passion and direct it in meaningful ways. To develop resources for processing and healing. To acquire tools for resisting and reimagining. To engage in and with life. And to contribute to and sustain ongoing conversations that are bigger than any one individual or institution. This last goal of contributing to larger conversations is inspired by Andrea Smith and her brief essay for a roundtable discussion on the academic industrial complex in a 2007 issue of the Journal of Feminist Studies and Religion. Here's what she sees as a primary goal for intellectual work. Our contribution should be seen as part of a larger collaborative intellectual project, whereby our goal is not to prove our own brilliance, but rather to perpetuate a conversation that will continue beyond our contribution. If years from now no one remembers what we said, then we still will have done important work if we did our part to keep the larger conversation going. What is the larger conversation that we need to keep going? For me, it's about exploring how and where we become thinking, feeling, and engaged selves, and it's about deeply questioning whether or not the academy is a space for fostering that development. While I have some ideas about how to answer the first part, I'm less certain about the second. What I do believe is that we need to make spaces for thinking critically about the limits of the academy, and we need to keep the conversation about how to resist, rethink, and even restructure it going. My initial contribution to this conversation was the posing of a highly personal question about what happened to my passion for being a scholar, and the exploration of an ethical response to that question that involves reimagining myself and my relation to academic values. In many ways, I wanted to use this talk, both the process of creating it, which was difficult, and my performance of it, as a way to experience the force of the question that I posed about my lost passion for academic work, to take seriously my conflicted feelings, to be curious about what other questions my question might raise about academic values and practices. After spending a lot of time working on and through this talk, I realized that I'm also hoping my accounts might serve as an example, not of how to be, but of proof that other ways of being are possible and imaginable and worth experimenting with. And I'm hoping that these accounts might serve as an invitation to all of you to share your stories about other ways of being, ways that have been ignored, dismissed, or maybe not even imagined yet.